Committee on Environment and Natural Resources will come to order. Our last meeting, we had a motion to lay Senator Sparks' bill on the table.
First.
That was a Senator Vickerman motion. Senator Vickerman has informed me that he wants to make a motion to remove that from the table with an intent to amend that bill. The way he's described his amendment, that would allay a great deal of concerns with that bill. So, Senator Vickerman.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I will move after laying the bill on the table because it's confusion. I'll have to plead ignorance because I was caught between here and there. I want to bring that bill back, and I think we'd like to pick up the double motion. Senate counsel could tell me exactly what that was. It's the noise, but this takes off the right to sue. I believe that. Am I right?
First, let's take the motion. Having voted on the prevailing side, Senator Vickerman moves.
You don't have to vote it on the prevailing side in committee.
It doesn't mean that doesn't matter. Anyway, Senator Vickerman moves to remove Senate File 311 from the table. Is that a debatable motion? That is not a debatable motion, I'm informed by research. So all those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Senate File 311 is the copy of Senate File 311 is in your folders.
Oh.
On top.
In the packet.
In your packet?
In the folder.
Your brown folder.
Turn on top.
So, Senator Vickerman, it's my understanding that you want to move to delete on page 1, line 18, everything after the period, delete line 19, and on line 20, all of the new language. Is that correct?
Correct.
Okay.
I'll make that motion.
Okay, Senator Vickerman makes that motion.
Mr. Chairman, question on that?
Senator Pearson.
Does the 1996 stay on line 18? It does. Okay.
Yes, it does.
And 20.
Yes, it does. And some conversations I've had with some of the opponents, not all, but some of the opponents are those who have concerns with this claimed exemption informed me that the residents will have, under the amendment, residents will have substantial rights to to object to whatever's going on with the Deer Creek racetrack. So we're with the Vickerman amendment, I think the situation is going to be copacetic. So is there any other discussion on the Vickerman amendment? And if there is, we'll certainly have time to hear about it because I'm going to lay Senate File 311 over anyway. Okay, seeing no further discussion, all those in favor of the Vickerman amendment, say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. With that, is there any further discussion on Senate File 311? Seeing none, Senate File 311 will be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus policy bill. Thank you, Senator Sparks.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Member.
Okay, Senate File 1173, Senator Tomasoni.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate File 1173 is a bill that authorizes the Iron Range Resources Board to use funds from one of our funds called the Douglas J. Johnson Economic Protection Fund to purchase forest land in the Taconite Assistance Area. Originally, it was from the Potlatch Corporation. I think the bill has been amended to just say from a corporation. The land would then be known as the Iron Range Miners Memorial Forest and would be held in trust for recreational uses and for economic purposes, which could include timber sales or gravel removal. And the proceeds from the timber sales or the gravel removal must be deposited in the Iron Range Miners Memorial Forest account, and up to an unspecified amount could be transferred into the Douglas J. Johnson Economic Protection Fund. Members, what's going on here is that this is just an authorization for the agency to be able to purchase this land. There's a huge tract of land. It's about 110,000 acres that Potlatch is considering selling. And what we're trying to do here is to make sure that we still have the people who will have access to it, and the forest won't get fragmented by individual sales here and there of private property, and then the normal uses of the forest, such as logging or recreational uses, are interrupted to the point where the forest land's original uses are no longer useful. So this is an attempt to keep the original purpose of the forest intact.
What does it mean that the forest lands have to be held in trust?
Mr. Chairman, that's a good question. But the I'm assuming that this public trust is in the event that there is timber sales or gravel removal from the area that maybe council could explain that better.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Tomasoni, I'm not an expert in this area, but I think the way the taconite tax works is it's a tax. I think it's in lieu of a property tax, isn't it, on the mining? And the money is basically to benefit the people within that area. And I think the issue here is trust for the benefit of the citizens of the area. I think that's the important phrase in there, that it's held in trust for their benefit, because this money is supposed to be benefiting all of the communities within the range, as I understand how this works.
I think the chair wants to know, though, what the forest trust land, what that actually refers to. Is that what you're thinking,
yeah,
Mr. Chairman?
Well, Mr. Chairman, Senator Thompson, I think it ties into the previous line there, the previous sentence, held in trust, and that these will be referred to as forest trust lands. They're not subject to another trust like the school trust lands, you know, like this.
Oh, okay.
But they are held in trust for the benefit of the citizens. So I think that's why they're referred to as trust lands.
Okay.
And so the memorial. You're saying any proceeds from the forest will go into.
It would be in the Douglas J. Johnson Economic Protection Fund. That's the trust fund that's currently at the IRRRB, and the only thing that we're allowed to spend out of that is the interest on that fund, unless there's specific action by the board that for a particular project that might be a big economic development project. So that trust fund continues to grow.
So proceeds go into the Memorial Forest account, and then the economic and then money can be transferred to the Economic Protection Trust Fund.
Correct.
Why doesn't it just stay in the account?
I think it's probably for flexibility purposes, but I'm not sure. I think it's probably going to be used for more than one thing.
Okay.
But maybe council can help me on that too.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Senator Tomasoni, the way I read this is, and I don't see the account being specified here. I'm assuming that account is going to be set up by the IRRRB, and that that this would allow them to use the money in the account to basically pay some of the costs of managing this land. But then this money may be transferred back into it, because you're going to use money from this protection trust fund. So if there's anything left over, you'd want to transfer it back in, then you could use that. Then that would go back into the corpus of that trust fund.
So IRRRB will be running this memorial forest, and the proceeds can be used to manage the forest or other things that the IRRRB does.
That's the idea, yeah.
Okay. Senator Dill.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Tomasoni, how much land do you expect to be able to purchase?
Well, I know they're putting 110,000 acres up for sale, and so that's what we'd be eligible to get. Whether or not we can afford that or how much the cost would be, I'm not sure. So I can't really give you a good answer to that question. Okay.
Well, Mr. Chairman, members, I have a bill that's designed to prevent the fragmentation of agricultural forest land and other open space land, which basically relies on local planning and zoning authorities to try to institute more stringent planning and zoning to protect open space. And I think this is a nice thing to do, but I think what it boils down to is it's probably not appropriate for government or others to government agencies and others to own all this land. The public can't afford to buy all this open space to protect it. We have to try to promote businesses that can farm and run forests and so forth and make money on it so they can protect open space for us. And with the help of planning and zoning laws, it can be applied statewide. To me, that's a much more comprehensive approach. And I hope what you're doing here works out. I'm glad you're doing this, but it's with a comprehensive approach to protect open space. There's got to be local planning and zoning because we can't afford to buy everything, and we shouldn't buy everything.
And Mr. Chair and Senator Dill, that's exactly the idea here, because we're afraid that if this is allowed to be sold off to private owners, that it will get all fragmented out, and access to the land that people are used to for recreation purposes or for logging purposes or for whatever they might normally be used for are going to be chopped up in all kinds of little squares, and then getting access to these forests is going to be very difficult. So that's the idea, that we keep this intact and that we manage it correctly.
Does the IRRRB do development as well? State development?
We do a real lot of economic development, yeah.
But as far as the land development goes with the...
Oh, there's a variety of things that we do, but most of it is the idea of getting somebody to manage it for us, or through the project that potentially comes to the agency as an economic development project.
But the clear intent of this is to preserve the forest,
exactly,
that forest land.
Exactly.
And so we have this huge forest fragmentation issue, and this is an example of a local entity making that big purchase to hold that forest area together.
And Mr. Chairman, I might just point out that this bill only gives us the ability to do the purchase, which we are not able to do right now. There's potentially we might not buy it because of some other reason, and I don't know what that might be, but without this law, then we would not have the ability to actually go and buy it, and that's the idea.
So the IRRRB has not assessed at all what it would cost to buy the whole 100,000 acres?
I don't know if they have or not. I haven't been...
It'd be nice to know, because... It would be nice for us to help if it's not able to buy the entire...
I'll remember that.
Yeah.
Okay.
I'm sorry, were there other questions? Senator Dill, did you have your hand up again?
Mr. Chair,
Senator Dill.
Senator Tomasoni, are there taxes being paid on this land now, and when this organization buys it, will there be taxes paid, or is this a government entity so there will not be taxes paid?
Well, I think Potlatch owns the property right now, so I'm assuming they're paying taxes on it. Yeah.
Well, what about after you buy it?
Well, that's where I would think the generation of money to the funds would come in. That if there's any kind of logging or any kind of gravel operations on there, then those kind of operations would pay. Because I don't think the IRRRB would be paying taxes to the IRRRB if they own the property. So maybe to the county, though. However,
so,
huh?
Mr. Chairman, to that point,
Senator Olson.
Well, Mr. Chairman, would they essentially take over paying PILT for those acreage, payment in lieu of taxes?
They aren't required to.
Mr. Knopf.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Olson. IRRRB is not required to pay PILT on lands. Only the PILT law we have in Minnesota is only for DNR lands.
But Mr. Chairman, you could... The law was created that did that. I presume if they were getting income off from it, you could, in fact, have them do that.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Olson, that would be up to the IRRRB, the way this bill is structured right now. If they wanted to do that, they could. pay back those local units of governments, or as Senator Tomasoni said, that money going back into the trust fund is used to benefit the area too. So it would just depend on how.
But this is private land right now, and it's going into. And so they're not receiving PILT payments on this land now.
Right, Mr. Chairman, they're not receiving them now, and they would not receive them after the purchase either, right. Unless the lands were somehow transferred to DNR.
So it has to be a DNR forest in order to receive a PILT payment.
Mr. Chairman, that's the way the PILT law is. It's DNR-administered lands.
Okay.
Or Mr. Chairman, if they're privately owned, they're paying taxes, are they not?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Olson, they are now.
Okay. It's a PILT is payment in lieu of taxes when it's a public, other than a private entity. That's in there. But is IRRRB a constitutional creation, or is it a statutory one in terms of its authority or what it might be required to do?
Mr. Knopf.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Olson, as I understand that it's statutory, not constitutional.
That's good.
So the intent of this is to preserve the forest from fragmentation and where possible, in a sustainable way, use timber and gravel harvesting to help pay for its management.
Correct.
Senator Saxog.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I look at it as another tool in the toolbox when we talk about fragmentation and access, just as forest legacy has come about, and we're talking about forest land consolidation now too. So. I think this is a good thing that the Iron Range Resources is doing for northern Minnesota.
Now, we have these regional economic commissions. Mm-hmm. Can they be doing things like this as well? For example, northwestern Minnesota?
Mr. Chairman, again, it's not something I know a lot about, but as I understand their charge, owning forest land would not be a charge of those commissions.
All right. Okay, does this need to go back to taxes? No?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I don't know what the committee's wishes on this is. As I understand it, I think that they're talking about including this in the tax bill.
Is it already in the tax bill?
It might be.
Okay.
Big tentative answer.
All right. You may want to send it back there just for formality, just to make sure it's back in the tax committee.
All right. Area. Yeah, and normally, it should have come to this committee first and then to taxes. But why don't we, Senator Saxog, will move that Senate file 1173 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Taxes. Any further discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you.
Thank you,
Mr. Chairman, committee members.
Senator Olson. Senator Olson, thank you for your patience. We appreciate it. And
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate your willingness to hear this bill and have some thorough discussion and airing of the issue that brings it before us.
And unlike last hearing, we're doing a lot better for time. So just go ahead and take the time you need, and we'll just make sure that opponents have an adequate amount of time as well.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think everybody's time is valuable, so we'll try to be as conservative with it as we can. I would like to make an author's amendment, oral author's amendment, to remove a couple of provisions in there that I think are, I would like not to have be the focus of the debate, and that is on page 1, line 8, to reinstate the stricken language. And on page 1, line 15 and 16, on line 15, delete the sentence that begins "no permit," and on line 16, delete the rest of that sentence. And I will tell you the reason that I am doing that. No.
First part, excuse me. What was the first part?
Mr. Chair, Senator Ingebrigtsen?
On line 8, Senator Ingebrigtsen?
No.
Delete the stricken language.
Reinstate.
Or reinstate the stricken
language. Reinstate the stricken
language.
Language.
Okay. Oh, well, this is an author's amendment, so is that all you had to in the amendment?
Yes.
Okay. So all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Amendment's adopted.
Thank you very much. I think the language that I've reinstated by taking that out would appear to have taken away all rulemaking authority and undo the entire rule. And there are only certain provisions of the current rule that I think are being challenged. And I think we want to keep the debate focused there and not take on the whole world here. And the other sentence that I removed, I believe, would probably put us into wetland law, and that also is not the intent. So I'd just like to share a few written comments that kind of set the stage and then turn to our testifiers. For over three decades, there's been dozens and dozens of lake associations and thousands of individual lakeshore owners who have responsibly used DNR permits to manage aquatic weeds. Most of these associations have actually improved the water quality and fish habitat of the lakes that they have managed. This is work that the overstretched DNR has not had to perform and taxpayers have not had to pay for. Yet the DNR has moved in recent years to roll back permitting to these lake homeowners and associations. A grandfather provision for controlling aquatic vegetation has been in effect since 1976 for several metro area lakes, including two bays on Lake Minnetonka in my district. And I have to acknowledge that one of them has a name that I had never heard of. These are very small bays. It allows a somewhat larger area to be treated in these cases than with other lakes in the state. The DNR has been in the process of amending Minnesota Rule 6280, the Aquatic Plant Management Policies, for nearly 4 years. The Lakeshore Owners Associations have tried unsuccessfully on a number of occasions to achieve a balanced rule that better serves the needs and desires of various interest groups. To date, DNR staff has not proffered any science-based reasons for the proposed changes. In regard to the grandfather provision, the DNR merely tells those affected that the provision is 30 years old and outdated. And as I said, probably they want to euthanize it rather than let it have a natural death. Grandfather doesn't live forever anyway. But additionally, with the explosion and growth of non-native invasive aquatic weeds, such as Eurasian milfoil, it seems that we need more citizens, not fewer, involved in helping turn back the growth of invasive weeds in our lakes. So that the issue is that the direction seems to be moving in the opposite direction that needs to be given what we are having to cope with in lakes. And I generally have been quite open in feeling that we need to be a bit more aggressive than the policy has allowed if we are going to, in fact, preserve the valuable natural resources that we have in our marvelous lakes. I will issue is centers around the efforts of the Minnesotans for Healthy Lakes, and I'd like to turn it to Bill Agpole, who is the leader of that organization, to give you some more information on what has transpired and what the concerns are, and introduce others that will testify as well.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you.
Please,
Senator.
Introduce yourself.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee members. Thank you, Senator Olson, for your leading comments. My name is Bill Iko. I am Executive Director of Minnesotans for Healthy Lakes. I'm also President of the Lake Emily Homeowners Association in Shoreview. Minnesotans for Healthy Lakes, we'll refer to as MHL, was organized in 2003 by a group of lakeshore property owners who were becoming concerned that new rules were on the horizon that would appear to be tightening down the restrictions on what could or could not be treated by way of aquatic weeds. repeated meetings as part of the process to develop these new rules that the DNR was discussing. We have held repeated meetings with them starting in 2003 and continuing almost to today to understand their concerns and to express ours as homeowners. At the request of the DNR, the issues we have had with the proposed rules were originally provided to them about 3 years ago and have been updated periodically since then, and those issues are in the packets that are available to you. When the proposed new rules were revealed to the public in December of 2005, they contained none of the provisions that the homeowners had presented, zero, which was extremely discouraging and disappointing to us after having spent hundreds and hundreds of man hours on the part of property owners and an equal number of man hours on the part of state employees, namely DNR personnel. And so literally this process over the last 3 or 4 years has been extremely expensive to all concerned. And to find that the product coming out at the end of the pipeline looks almost identical to what it was at the start of the pipeline causes us to feel that we have been marginalized and that the attempt to gain inputs from stakeholders may not have been totally sincere. The new rules were applied in the field starting in 2004. We saw them again in 2005 and again in 2006, even though the changes had not gone through the formal rule-changing process, which started officially in December of 2005. This practice became most obvious in 2006, with hundreds of property owners having permits denied or shoreline footage significantly reduced in compliance with the new rules. I have approximately 150 permit denials or reductions in front of me from 2006 that can support the fact that permits were reduced by as little as 5 feet from that requested. Many were 10 feet, some were 15, some were 20, and many were rejected altogether for reasons that were quite arbitrary. And this is why we believe very strongly that although the new rules have not been officially approved, they are being applied by policy in the field. When some of our homeowners have asked the inspectors in the field, why are you, I've been getting 100 feet of allowed footage for 10 years, why are you cutting me back to 70? The comments that were given to the homeowners go along the line of, we are going to right some old wrongs, end quote. I have correspondence from homeowners to that regard in front of me. We believe that these new rules provide overprotection specifically to invasive species, thus allowing them to continue to spread across an ever-increasing number of Minnesota lakes. The number is growing every year. Eurasian water milfoil at last count was about 160 lakes and growing. Curly leaf pondweed is over 700 lakes and growing every year. The photographs that you may have in front of you, we had hoped to get them on the wall because in living color they're quite impressive, but those photographs are taken on one of the boat ramps of Lake Minnetonka. That's Eurasian water milfoil. When the wind is blowing onshore, that stuff piles up to the extent that I challenge anyone in the room to clean a boat and trailer adequately to prevent that stuff from going to other lakes. Now, it's true that there are steam cleaning equipment and so forth out there that has been demonstrated but has still not been implemented to try to control the problem. But when you have the overwhelming abundance of that stuff in the water, it's just about impossible to prevent its spread. Point being that we have not been aggressive enough in controlling this kind of invasive species, and until we take effective measures, the problem will continue to expand. One concern we have is that the new rules are going to make it more difficult to maintain clean and clear shorelines, and will lead to increased non-permitted and non-regulated shoreline management, or vigilantes. We don't advocate it. We don't defend it. But the tougher we make it for homeowners to keep their shorelines clean, the more motivation we have for that undesirable behavior. These new, more restrictive rules will require a higher level of DNR inspection and enforcement of routine permit applications, while the threats of new invasive species such as zebra mussel, hydrilla, next-generation milfoil, and so forth receive inadequate attention by limited staff. By micromanaging the permitting process to as little as 5 feet at a time, the DNR is failing to optimize the use of their staff. In time, we're convinced more staff will be required if these new rules become in effect. MHL is appealing to our state legislators to represent the interests of Minnesota lakeshore property owners to enable them to maintain their shorelines in a clean and healthy state. We believe that a fair balance between the interests of lakeshore property owners, environmentalists, recreational users, and sportsmen is needed. Property values at stake. One of the other testifiers will give some specifics relative to the correlation between quality of the lakeshore and the value of property. Direct related to this concern is the fact that the Fisheries Division of the DNR is responsible for oversight of the Aquatic Plant Management Program. As such, it is reasonable to expect that decisions will not be made in a fair and unbiased fashion, but will have a strong propensity to favor the sports fishing lobby. This simply is not fair to property owners. We ask, why is Ecological Services Division not responsible for the program? We're asking for a fair shake. In addition, we're asking our legislators to require future proposed rule changes to be submitted and approved by the appropriate committees of both houses. We believe that greater legislative oversight is needed. Rule changes of the magnitude proposed here will have a significant negative impact on the use of shoreline by property owners and upon their property values. Such an impact should not be allowed without the full involvement of our elected representatives who are directly responsible to the voters of Minnesota. I would like to summarize what I just said with 3 points. We can cut through everything. In the case of native species, we are asking that those rules which have been in effect effectively and successfully for at least the last 3 decades be left in place regarding the amount of shoreline footage, grandfather clause, and so forth. After hundreds of hours of studying this issue, we are unable to find any reasonable justification for changing the rules regarding natives. Second point, regarding invasive species, we strongly believe that they should be treated much more aggressively. They are infesting more and more lakes, and it's obvious that whatever we've been doing is not adequate enough. We are not asking for state handouts. In most cases, with the exception of large lakes like Minnetonka, where there's so much real estate that you do need some grants and funding, homeowners are not asking for state aid to manage that precious resource, which is so key to their property values. We believe invasives should be managed far more aggressively than has been allowed under current rule. And thirdly, we are asking for oversight by our legislators through the environment committees of both houses. We strongly believe that the DNR should not be allowed to make rules that have the sweeping magnitude to affect many stakeholders and affect property value significantly without having your oversight.
Who else can make the rules? I can.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Yes, I'd like to introduce Jim Idy. Jim is president of the Cedar Island Lake Homeowners Association in Maple Grove.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Welcome to the committee.
Members. Cedar Island Lake is a 90-acre lake located in Maple Grove.
Would you mind introducing yourself for the record?
My name is James Idy.
Thank you.
I'm president of the Cedar Island Lake Homeowners Association located in Maple Grove.
Thank you.
It's a 90-acre lake with 85 homeowners, and they are members of the Cedar Island Lake Homeowners Association, which was formed over 30 years ago with the express purpose of caring for Cedar Island Lake. Our association is formal with a full slate of officers and subcommittees. We meet throughout the year, and number one on our agenda is caring for the lake. Each year, we spend between $10,000 and $12,000 of our own money to treat the lake for invasive weeds. We've been good stewards of the lake, and there is a true balance of open water, shoreline vegetation, and areas of lily pads. This lake does not have streams or natural springs. It receives its water from rain, snow, and a significant runoff from freeways and adjacent land. As good stewards, we believe that entangling us in an elongated paper process of variances is not an efficient use of taxpayer money when our own money we have maintained and improved Cedar Island Lake. For over 30 years, we've had a grandfather permit to treat up to 40% of the lake for invasive weeds. Should the DNR rules go into effect, we would be allowed to treat only 15% of the lake, which in time would return to a swamp lake appearance. This lake is rich in nutrients, and untreated weeds grow rapidly. Our caring for this lake has allowed it to be used as a recreational lake. This is definitely a recreational lake and not a fishing lake. We are receiving proposals to spend our own money to update our lake management plan and intend to work closely with the DNR to continue to improve and maintain the lake. We believe that the implementation of the 50% rule would create a loss of enjoyment and beauty, as well as unknown but significant loss of property values. I have a comparative market analysis prepared by a realtor active in my immediate area, which concluded that if the six properties on Cedar Island Lake that were either for sale or recently off the market in November 2006 were now on Cedar Island Lake and it had been converted to a swamp-like appearance, the average reduction in value would exceed $200,000 each home. If we compute this to the 85 homes on Cedar Island Lake, it would mean a loss in taxable value of $17 million. Even if this market analysis is off by 10 or 15%, it would be a huge deduction in taxable value and a personal loss to each homeowner. The DNR representative assigned to review our yearly application for vegetation control addressed our fall 2006 homeowners meeting. When asked if he had a current information about Cedar Island Lake, he said the information in his file was over 20 years old and he had never visited the lake. Working with this greatly limited information, he is directly involved in setting the degree of vegetation control we can apply. I'm concerned that others in the DNR are also working with outdated information and lack of personal information about the grandfathered lakes. The proposed DNR ruling to limit the grandfathered permits was a total surprise to our association. We heard of this only in the spring of 2006. The Maple Grove Quality Commission, the officers of our association, as well as our lake representative on our lake, who has signed for the weed control permit these past 4 years, were never notified, were never listed as stakeholders, and were not surveyed by the University of Minnesota as indicated to be accomplished by published DNR guidelines for the stakeholder listening sessions, which began in mid-2003. We believe that DNR proposal to roll back the treatment of vegetation on our grandfathered lake is a true waste of limited time and money for the DNR, when the homeowners on these lakes have proven to be effective in maintaining and improving the quality of these lakes for over 30 years. We ask, why make a major change when our system is working? To this date, we have not received one scientific proof that these lakes would be improved by this dramatic reduction in weed control. We ask that the grandfather permits remain in force, or at the very least, a scientific evidence be implemented. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Roger Williams. I am on the board of directors of the Lake Johanna Improvement Society. That's in Senator Chaudhry's district. I'm not only on the board of directors, I'm a muskie person. I fish muskies. And I will tell you that without plants, as DNR calls them, or weeds, as fishermen call them, you don't have muskies, and you don't have bass, and you don't have walleyes, and you don't have anything else. So I'm the last person that wants to see a wholesale destruction of plants or weeds. We've been treating Lake Johanna for over 30 years, since before 1976, when the grandfather provision was effective. We have historic photos that show Lake Johanna as such a mess, such a tangle of plants, that literally it prohibited use of virtually any kind. We have applied chemicals to Lake Johanna in strict accordance with DNR permits. I want to emphasize that, in strict accordance with DNR permits, every year for 30 years. We are allowed to treat 29% of the littoral area of the lake. That's the shoreline that is 15 feet deep or less. We treat 29%. That's all. Shallow bays aren't treated. Lily pads aren't treated. Good fish habitat and duck habitat and so on aren't treated. We feel that we've done a pretty good job over the last 30 years. Lake Johanna is 200 acres, smack dab in Ramsey County. It's an urban lake. On the North Shore, Tony Schmidt County Park, managed by Ramsey County, was just upgraded this last year to regional park status. Not exactly the sign of a mismanaged resource. Lake Johanna is a muskie lake. It's one of the metro muskie lakes that's on the annual muskie tournament. And lots of people fish not only at the tournament time, but routinely for muskies and other fish on Lake Johanna. Again, not exactly the sign of a mismanaged resource. More recently, I'd say 5, maybe 6, 7 years, 4 or 5, somewhere in that vicinity, DNR started stocking walleyes in Lake Johanna. Not exactly the sign of a mismanaged resource. It's already been said that we have gotten no justification for removing the grandfather provision except it's, hey, it's 30 years old. It's not effective anymore. Well, I feel that a division of ecological services ought to be based on science, not on the fact that something is 30 years old and that's it. We're told that it's no longer effective, or it's no longer permissible to have a grandfather provision because of increased lakeshore development, and it's further causing more and more plants to be destroyed. Lake Johanna has no undeveloped property. There are some new houses going up, but old houses are coming down to make room for new houses. And I suspect that Lake Johanna is probably not the only one of the grandfathered lakes. I think there are 7 of them. Is that right? 7? 9, 7 lakes and 2 bays on Lake Minnetonka. And I don't know for a fact that's true, but I suspect that some of those other lakes are also fully developed. We are told that, you know, the unfortunate thing is that we don't have a rule. So we can't really show you things in the rule that we object to, but we have some material from DNR that's about a year old that tells basically what they plan to do with the rule, so we assume that they're still headed in that direction. We're told not to worry about losing the grandfather provision because there will be a variance process, and the variance process will be based on the development of a lake-wide management plan. Now, that doesn't sound all bad. That sounds like it makes some sense. But we're kind of asked to buy a pig in a poke here because there is no template as to what a lake management plan will contain. DNR says it's working on it. I mean, they've been working on this for 4 years, but we still haven't seen what this lake management plan looks like. We don't know the content. We don't know what it will take for DNR to approve a management plan. It's kind of a joint approval process between the Lake Association and DNR, so we don't know what DNR will be looking for to approve it. And we don't know what the criteria will be that DNR will use to grant a variance. So without a rule, we're being asked to accept that as being better than the grandfather provision that we now have, where we can treat 29% of the lake. I fault the process in this. I think it's too bad that we have to come to you and ask you for help. I think that DNR, knowing this was going to be a controversial rule, at least they should have had a what I call a negotiated rulemaking process. They should have established a committee of people with various interests, fisher people, lakeshore owners, and whoever else, a committee of folks that work with them month after month after month in meetings to try and hammer out a rule that reaches accommodation and compromise, something that could be accepted, something that won't be criticized or contested the second it hits the street sometime after the end of the year. It will be contested. It'll go to public hearing. The administrative law judges will have a go at it and so on and so forth. And when it goes out state to Alexandria, to Grand Rapids, to wherever, here in the metro area, more and more people will find out about it, both pro and con. And I bet you it's going to come right back here next session because people are really going to be upset with it. So I fault the process. I fault the fact that we don't have information on why these rule changes are desirable from a scientific basis. And again, as a fisher person and a lakeshore owner, I want balance. I want a fair rule that tries to be good to our lakes and for the benefit of all users. Thank you.
I'll let you know.
Question for the witnesses. Senator Chair Egbertson.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Could you tell me what kind of cost you're talking about? The landowners are doing that every year. What kind of costs are you incurring yourself?
On Lake Johanna, it's voluntary. We collect the money with from the association. We contract with an applicator. They give us a price based on generally 1 or 2 sprayings of plants, depending upon what they are, and usually 1 spraying for algae. because it starts to cook in the summertime. And this year we're asking for $3 a front foot, which isn't to say that that a front foot of the whole property gets get applied, but that's the way we do the basis of charge. And I think on Lake Johanna, you're asking me a question, and I'm going to have to guess. I think the cost is something like around $20,000, something like that.
A year,
right. And we hire one applicator, and that applicator goes to DNR with one permit, and so the individual property owners are not asking for separate permits.
So Lake Johanna has one. It's a business that does this type of thing, and they hire that business to.
Mr. Chair, members, that's okay. That's correct.
All right, and so that's how you arrive at the total 15%, as opposed to calculating it somehow from each individual doing their own shoreline.
Right, Mr. Chair, members, again, on Lake Johanna, we treat 29% of that shoreline that's 15 feet deep or less.
Okay. And is it it's spot treatment?
Yes.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, members, we were, and we're very careful. We kind of pride ourselves on the way we do this. We had, I'm the point person on Lake Johanna. If there are complaints, I'm the one that gets the emails and telephone calls. And there were people that weren't real happy last summer because they saw more plants than what they normally do. And we explained it's an extraordinarily hot summer. Lack of rainfall, low water levels caused our lake to cook. And I would guess that many lakes cooked last summer, and so the plant growth was much greater. But when we went out, I took the contractors out on my pontoon. It's a nice platform to be able to see what's really going on. We can get in shallow areas and so on and so forth. And what we found out is that the plants that they were complaining about are actually beneficial plants, the ones that we want to keep. And so we explained to them what the situation was, showed them diagrams of what those plants looked like, and told them that those were not plants that we intended to eradicate.
And Mr. Ide, on your lake, is it the same? You use the same process, or do individuals do their own?
We do the same process. Each individual does fill out a request for us as an association to contract with a approved DNR contractor to do the work, but we do it as an association. To date, we have about 40% of the people signed up already for this next season, which starts in May, early June, and the balance will sign up, or the bulk of those people will sign up at our April 11th meeting.
In the bill, on the first page, it talks about permits requests must be granted for up to 15% of a water basin's total littoral area. That sounds like it's about twice as less as what Mr. Williams was describing for Lake Johanna. And I thought you said Cedar Lake, you were doing 40%.
Up to 40. Okay. It has in later years been cut back by the local DNR representative that we work with to 36, 37, or some other percent, but it's...
So, Senator Olson, you're...
Mr. Chairman, the provision that these two gentlemen have been testifying about is on page 2, lines 12 through 14, the littoral limit exception. They're representing two of the grandfathered lakes. What they are protecting on the page 1 is that to leave the current limitations... that are within the 15, they're not trying to change that 15% littoral area that has been in place since 1976. They're just trying to leave that in place. But the rule apparently is doing other than that, because people that have attested to Mr. Eichel that their permits have not been allowed to meet this particular requirement that's in the current rule.
I thought individuals generally were not applying for permits. They were contracting with one.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I think that's what what has been that I'm learning from their testimony is an efficiency that the grandfathered lakes are experiencing.
Okay.
Because they are grandfathered and they know what their restrictions are, they are coordinating that effort and doing it in a simple way rather than individuals coming in and permitting, having to do separate separate treatment applications and not having the valuable experience. I think we lose sight of sometimes we don't as professionals in different fields. We may not respect the knowledge and the dedications that people have to natural resources and have done their homework and are really trying to be responsible in the way that they carry out these processes.
All right. So page one, you would like to retain the ability of an individual to do this aside from the
that's what the law has been through the current rule has been through since 1976. These gentlemen are defending leaving the grandfather in place because there is no evidence that they haven't been responsible in carrying out the provisions of those permits that were granted before that time and actually having good results in the management of their lakes. And their understanding is that the direction of the rulemaking process would just eliminate that.
Senator Sharon.
Thank you.
Mr. Iacocca would just like to add to that.
Okay. Mr. Chairman and committee members, I'd like to clarify. The discussion has been heavily focused on the grandfathered lakes issue because both of my colleagues who have testified are from grandfathered lakes. The large majority of lakes that represent our constituents are not grandfathered. The several hundred other lakes across Minnesota that MHL represents are not grandfathered. Again, remember, there are only seven lakes plus two bays of Minnetonka in the metro area that are grandfathered. And let me just explain, the reason they were grandfathered is that prior to 1976, when the 15% rule was put in place, these lakes had effective management programs in place. They were proving at that time that they were good stewards of their lake. The 15% rule, as best I can determine, was based that time by the DNR on some very soft scientific data. Other states, at least some other states, allow substantially more than that amount of surface area to be treated. Michigan, for example, routinely allows whole lake treatment for invasive species. And their fishing industry is alive and well. So I want to clarify that the reason we are speaking on behalf of the hundreds of other lakes that are not on the grandfathered list is that there is an additional provision in the new proposed rules that will throw them into chaos. And that is contained in lines 12 through 14. Okay. Today, individual homeowners, whether they apply through an association or individually, are allowed by permit to treat up to 100 feet of shoreline, typically by about 150, some cases 200 feet lakeward. That's routine. That's existing language. The new rules, I'm sorry, let me finish that. 100 feet of shoreline, up to 100 feet, or the full width of the property, whichever is less. A person with 90 feet is allowed to treat 90 feet routinely. And our homeowners accept that. Our homeowners accept the 15%, other than the grandfathered lakes, and our homeowners accept up to 100 feet. However, the new rules read up to 100 feet or one half the shoreline, whichever is less. So that same homeowner that has been getting 90 feet low all these years suddenly gets 45 feet. And he asks, why? And we certainly cannot provide an answer to that, and we have not been able to obtain an answer based on scientific data from the DNR. So these are two rules that are based upon this increasing development of lakeshore property around the state that is endangering the habitat. That I'm sorry, I'm an engineer by training, and I cannot follow the logic that there's a cause and effect situation here. So, as I said, for the native species specifically, and I'm talking now the 100 feet or the full width and the grandfather, those have been on the books for over 30 years, and we're saying we have not seen justification to change them.
Senator Sharon.
I really am appreciating this discussion. My family has had a cabin on a lake home, and we are a part of a lake lake association, Lake Washington, near Mankato-St. Peter area, that does oversee this lake, and the invasive species in our lake are horrific. And I am very concerned that even what you're doing here is trying to retain what exists, and yet I don't think what exists is really addressing the issue of invasive species. And so not only would I support the things that you're talking about, because I see it, I see all, you know, they have all of the public access and no control over what kind of species is being brought in and out of this lake. And it's left to the people around the lake to try to manage the lake, but there's no control or containment of what's happening and coming in and out of this lake. We don't have any control. And yet you're left without the capacity to control the invasive species.
Yep, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Olson.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Sharon, the on page 2, line 8 and 9, that is one thing we have extended, granting permits of control for control of aquatic non-native invasive species. Absolutely. Without littoral area limits. Now, that may seem like it is taking the total lid off, and there may be, maybe there needs to be a lake management plan or whatever, but nonetheless, it's acknowledging that we cannot go the reverse way if we are ever going to get a handle on the invasive species. So we're attempting to deal with that, or at least open that dialogue and recognize that I think the legislature needs to be a part of that debate in helping to determine that direction with the DNR, rather than to see a rule go in place that seems to go in the opposite direction. And at the same time, in our environment funding bill, we're increasing licenses on boats, things that affect property owners as well as other recreational users, and other licenses for invasive species without seeing much of a plan. In fact, seeing some things that seem to be working against the very thing that we're trying to do in terms of,
that's right,
of slowing that spread. I do also want to, in case you think that Lake Minnetonka is all grandfathered in, this is a picture of Lake Minnetonka. Now, wait a minute. This one is actually bigger, so this one is better. The grandfathered bays are right here. Little piece right here. So if you think that the whole of Lake Minnetonka is grandfathered in to go, to do anything, the Carson's Bay is right in this area, and I'd never heard of St. Louis Bay, which is the other one. It's right adjacent to it. It's a little tiny bay where the old Hotel St. Louis was that has been long gone. But that is the two, plus the other lakes that are totally, essentially, they've been developed to what they're going to be, those grandfathered lakes. And I think that should probably be used as models of what can be done when you get a homeowners association working together and having a plan that appears to balance those interests as well as protect the natural resource that we all value.
Mr. Chairman?
Sam Parasol.
Chairman, in addition to what Senator Olson responded to your question, Ms. Sharon, is the language on lines 2-4 and 2-5, where actually if they have approved or denied within the 15-day limit, failure to deny or issue or deny within this time constitutes a default approved to proceed. So obviously it's going in the direction Senator Olson wants, and that you do too, I think.
Mr. Chairman, that I believe is rather important. I've been working with another lake association, and I'm not sure how they're affected by this, but they've done a fabulous job of both controlling the Eurasian milfoil. They've got it down to the point where they've got spotters looking for individual plants that reappear, and they do have a permit for going out and zapping that one plant. But they're dealing with the curly leaf pondweed, and there's hundreds of lakes dealing with curly leaf pondweed. And if you have a delay in permit and are not able to do it in a timely way, there's a certain time when that treatment has to be applied. Otherwise, there is going to seed, it is aggravated, and if we don't get the curly leaf pondweed under control, as this lake is out in western Hennepin County, what they're appealing, they're working with the watershed district on an ecological basis, because it is feeding the phosphorus loading in that lake so that it will be in impaired waters. And they're trying to prevent getting their lake into the impaired waters category and having to go through all that you have to go through to try to reclaim it. So there's an assumption that there's an adversarial role on the part of lake associations and landowners with some of the natural resources and the environmental interests, when it is just not the case.
Okay, why don't we hear from the DNR? Thank you, gentlemen.
Steve Hurst.
Mr. Chair, can I just ask one question of the gentleman who says he's a musky fisherman? Can you tell me how the fishing is on your lake now?
Mr. Williams, please don't.
Oh, no, I live on a beautiful lake. I don't need that lake. I'm really inquiring as to how the fishing is with the control that they've been doing.
It's good.
That's all I want to know.
If you know the lure to use and the place to go. But it's only a 200-acre lake, so you don't have too many.
Mr. Chair, follow up on it. If you're a musky fisherman, you have a lot of time on your hands.
Permission, right? Okay. Mr. Hirsch?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. Steve Hirsch, DNR Ecological Services. And I very much appreciate the opportunity to come in and talk to you this evening about the issues that are being raised tonight. And I know that there are important issues and that there are a wide range of diverging opinions on these issues, and I'd just like to talk about some of that a little bit. I'd like to start off just by sort of giving a brief overview of the Aquatic Plant Management Program, very brief, talk about some of the challenges we've been facing there. I want to address the invasive species issues. I want to talk about the science and clarify what we do have for the science, which is quite a bit. I want to talk about the rulemaking process that we're currently in. And then I also want to talk specifically about some of the things in the bill that concern us, and I will try to do that in summary fashion.
Well, Mr. Hirsch, this is turning out to be controversial issues, so as much information as you can give us I think will be helpful.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The Aquatic Plant Management Program has been around early 1950s. There may have even been some early activity in the late 1940s. The original premise of the program, and I think this is a very important point, was to provide shoreline property owners access to open water when that access was impeded by aquatic plants, while protecting the habitat and water quality value of aquatic plants. And I think it's a fair statement to say that there's been substantial drift away from that original premise over the years. And it's been caused by a number of things that I think we all know are occurring. One is just the rampant increase in lakeshore development. Everybody wants a home on the lake. But in addition to that, it's the fact that this development is becoming more upscale. That's very significant. So no longer is the 15-foot boat channel out to open water sufficient. Now a person wants 75, 80, 100, 150 feet for numerous water toys and big docks and so on. And then the other issue is that the development we're seeing is occurring increasingly on areas that were formerly considered undevelopable, namely shallow vegetated areas, shallow bays that, you know, back in 1960 would have been thought by a realtor to not even be developable. That's becoming prime lakeshore real estate because nothing else is available. So that's the trend, and that's what we're faced with. And what's been happening is ever-increasing number of aquatic plant management permits that we've been issuing since the early 1990s. That number has gone up literally every year. In fact, just to give you an example, in 2004, we issued 3,600 permits for 10,600 properties. 2 years later, in 2006, that number is up to 4,300 permits for almost 12,000 properties. So where it's going to end, I don't know, but this is something that we're seeing. It's increasing every year. It's a trend that is posing issues for our lakes, and I'll talk more about that as we go on. The other thing that I want to emphasize is that aquatic plants are a public resource. They belong to the state. They belong to the public. So this is not a landowner rights issue, as it has sometimes been portrayed. And I want to make it very clear that aquatic plants have habitat and water quality value, as Mr. Williams alluded to. We tend to call them weeds, and I'm an angler, too, and I'm guilty of it, too. We talk about fishing in the weed beds. We call them weeds, but they're not really weeds the way we think of weeds. They're not the dandelions that we spray on our front lawn, and they're not the weeds that we pull out of our garden. They're plants. They have value. Notwithstanding the fact that we have issues with invasive species, these things are aquatic plants, but I think our tendency to refer to them as weeds over time and talking about lakes becoming swamp-like because there's too many weeds has really colored our attitude on how we view aquatic plants, and I think that's an issue. Certainly, the department recognizes that invasive aquatic plants are a huge concern for the lake, for the lakes of our state. I think we're demonstrating that the DNR is concerned about that. We've got a grant program for local groups to treat invasive aquatic plants that we've increased just in the last couple of years from $100,000 a year to $380,000 a year. And under the governor's budget, that amount would increase to the amount would increase by $800,000 a year in the second year of the biennium. So we certainly know that invasive species are a huge concern and something that we need to address. But unfortunately, in the discussion of aquatic plant management issues, the invasive species issues have become, in my view, confused with the issues surrounding the need to protect aquatic plants. And I think there's a couple of important points that go along with that. First is the rules as they are, or the rules as we would propose them, are not going to facilitate the spread of aquatic invasive species. And if you think that may seem counterintuitive, but if you think about it, and you think about a landowner that's clearing invasive aquatic plants along their shoreline in the near shore area, and you think about the way boat travel occurs on a lake, most of the boats that are water skiing or just recreational boating don't go that close to shore. If they do, they're going to likely go over aquatic plants that are outside from the treatment area, and if there's invasives, they're going to run into contact with them. Anglers that are fishing in and around aquatic plants pick them up on their lures, they pick them up on their electric trolling motor, they're still going to get invasive aquatic plants. So having lakeshore owners be able to treat larger portions of their shoreline, it sounds like it might help, but I don't think it's really going to help stop the spread of invasive aquatic plants. More importantly, I think, is that the language, as you see, in other words, increasing the amount of control that's allowed, is not, I think, going to stop the spread of invasive aquatic plants either. We're still learning quite a bit about how to effectively control Eurasian water milfoil and curly leaf pondweed in our lakes. But one thing we do know, we have seen some successes, at least some short-term successes, but one thing we do know is that it has to be based on a plan. I think Senator Olson alluded to that very correctly. It has to be based on a plan, has to be well thought out. The treatments have to be repeated periodically. It has to be evaluated to make sure you're reaching that goal. And you're not going to achieve that simply by liberalizing what an individual shoreline property owner can do. It's just too, I know it sounds promising, but it's just too piecemeal. And I really don't think we're going to achieve the goal of stopping the spread of invasive species simply by liberalizing herbicide control for aquatic plants in general. I do want to get into the science part of this now a little bit, because there's been a lot of concern that the DNR is not basing the decisions on science, and we are. I think there's been some talking past each other when we talk about the science with some of our stakeholders, and maybe I can help to clarify some of that tonight. But I think, first of all, the one thing I want to emphasize is there is a problem here. And we all know that our lakes are showing trends in the state that are not good, that habitat quality is declining. Yes, that decline is not due solely to herbicide control of aquatic plants, but we think that increasing herbicide control of aquatic plants is a piece of the puzzle, and that is one of the things that's causing decline in our lakes. And the science is very clear on this, that aquatic plants have value. They have habitat value and they have water quality value. Fish abundance and species diversity is higher in vegetated habitats, and it declines as aquatic vegetation is lost. Fish community composition shifts from game fish species and minnow species to things like carp and bullhead when you lose aquatic vegetation. We've seen species such as black chin shiners, black nose shiners, and banded killifish disappear from some metro area lakes where we've seen big declines in aquatic habitat. Those are sort of the piscatorial canaries in the coal mine, if you will. And you know, one of the lakes this has happened on is Lake Johanna, one of the grandfather lakes. Now, I want to hasten to add that I'm not saying that we know for sure that the aquatic plant control that's occurred on Lake Johanna has been what's caused this, but it could very well be part of the problem with the long-term habitat declines that are causing the absence of some of these species. We just started some recent surveys last year as part of a sensitive shoreline assessment project that we're doing to identify critical fish and wildlife habitat. And this data right off the bat is clearly showing that the shallow vegetated bays have higher species diversity, not just of fish, but wildlife species, amphibian species, and that the shallow bays with aquatic vegetation are extremely important for this habitat diversity. And really, the body of scientific information on this is growing by leaps and bounds. The Division of Fish and Wildlife Section of Fisheries in 2004 published this special publication called The Role of Submersed Aquatic Vegetation as Habitat for Fish in Minnesota Lakes, including the implications of non-native plant invasions and their management, and sort of summarizes the state of the science on how important aquatic plants are for fish and wildlife habitat. The really good thing about it, is, aside from the summary, is there's a reference section with literally pages of scientific references that backs up the information in this publication. So it's sort of a compendium on the state of the science. And it's available on the DNR website. In fact, I printed out and I can make this available to the committee if you want to print copies for the members. I printed out the hot links that you can use to get to this specific publication. And then also this publication, which is Fisheries Management Section Investigation Report Number 537, Relationship Between Aquatic Plant Cover and Fish Populations Based on Minnesota Lake Survey Data. So maybe I could give you, this is just a map that's pretty, two maps actually, that show what I was just talking about the increased incidence of different numbers of fish and wildlife species in the shallow vegetated bays, which might be interesting to look at too. But you know, I want to clarify that I don't think the aquatic plant management rules as they have been in place for a number of decades have been a disaster by any means. I think that for the most part they have worked. I think what the department is proposing, which I'll get into in a minute, Mr. Iko actually had a pretty good explanation for the two proposals that are creating the most concern. I think that they've worked pretty well for the most part, but I think there are some disturbing trends that if we don't get on top of them and make sure that we address, we're going to find ourselves running to catch up, and that's really what the department is concerned about. I think with that, I'll talk a little bit about the actual rules and the rulemaking process. And just, you know, one of the things I want to just mention is it's been stated a couple times, and I've heard it quite a bit, that this process has gone on for a long time, and it has. But actually, and I believe Mr. Iko stated this correctly, but the actual rulemaking process began in December of 2005 when we published the request for comments. But prior to that, we went through an extensive program review, which wasn't necessarily just about changing the rules, although that got to be a big part of what one of the outcomes was. But that program review, I think Mr. Iko talked about it, actually started in 2003 and went on for a couple years. We did listen to numerous stakeholders that had opinions from you know, all across the board, from not wanting to ever kill an aquatic plant, whether it was invasive or not, to Katie barred the door for herbicide control. And there's a real divergence of opinion. And I appreciate, you know, Mr. Williams' comments certainly about a negotiated rulemaking process, but I certainly think we got a very good across-the-board representation of the different viewpoints that are out there, and that we went into the rulemaking process that we're undertaking right now with our eyes wide open in terms of what the different viewpoints are, and we knew that some of this would be controversial. With that, maybe I'll talk a little bit about what the DNR is proposing by rule. The two most controversial provisions, and Mr. Iko already referred to them, are the elimination of the grandfather provision and then the decrease in the amount of submersed aquatic vegetation control that an individual shoreline property owner can do. The grandfather provision, I think, has been adequately explained. It's true that one of the things the department has said about it is that, hey, you know, this provision is 30 years old. We're basically automatically approving these permits for, what I would call extremely high levels of herbicide control without any sort of review to see what's actually happening, to see whether or not it's actually needed. I would offer that the rule does say that this is at the discretion of the DNR, so we don't have to, by rule, allow these elevated levels of control. We have been. We decided that it would be more upfront and more straightforward to go through a rulemaking process and eliminate it rather than to use our existing authority and just start cutting people back. But I think if you look at the overall concern with loss of aquatic plants, loss of habitat, and the amounts of control going on in these lakes, I think it's a reasonable position for the department to take to say, look, we should look at these lakes the way that we look at all the other lakes in the state to see if this additional control is justified. And we should look at it through a variance or a lake vegetation management plan process to determine that and not just automatically rubber stamp these every year. So that was our reasoning on that. And I do think there's some science behind it in terms of the overall need to protect aquatic plants. The second provision that's created the concern has to do with decreasing the amount of aquatic plant control for submersed aquatic plants along an individual shoreline property owner's shoreline. And the existing rule says that we may allow a maximum of 100 feet. We have been cutting back the amount of shoreline footage allowed for herbicide control for years, not just since we decided to propose these rules. I think that there's been a perception that we've started to implement these rules before they're promulgated, but we've actually been cutting back the amount of shoreline allowed for years. It's based on judgment calls from field biologists that go out and inspect properties. I was in fisheries prior to 2004 myself, and I remember dealing with complaints about us cutting back properties for aquatic plant control well before I came to Ecological Services in 2004. So that's really nothing new. The existing rule language, at least the way we interpret it, gives us the latitude to do that. And I don't think we've been trying to promulgate the rules before they're implemented. Certainly we've not given any verbal or written direction to field staff to do that. Some of the other things quickly that we're doing as part of the rulemaking process is we are looking at improving the variance language to facilitate control of invasive species where it's warranted. We're looking at describing the actual criteria that go into lake vegetation management plans. So we will have the variance criteria and the lake vegetation management plan criteria as part of this rule package. We won't have implementation of some rules to eliminate the grandfather clause before we have rules that provide more direction for lake vegetation management plans and variances, although I would add that the department does have a template for a lake vegetation management plan. We've done lake vegetation management plans with other groups around the state. We are working on an abbreviated template because the template we do have is a bit long.
Why don't we, Mr. Hirsch, since this kind of 15% seems to be the the crux of the matter, could you go into some more detail on why you need to reduce that? What got Special Publication 160, Investigational Report 537. Maybe you can talk about what's in those reports and how do you know that 15% is where you need to be?
Mr. Chairman, it's an excellent question. We are not planning on changing the 15% limit as part of our rule changes. That's currently in rule, and it's not one of the things that we're going to that we plan on changing. Okay. And in fact, many of the provisions in the bill address things in rule that we're not really planning on changing. The way that every time that we've implemented changes to our aquatic plant management rules, they have been challenged, and we've gone in front of an administrative law judge. And the way that was justified when we promulgated the rule is that the department can't say, and this is where we maybe kind of talk past each other a little bit on the whole science issue, but the department can't say with certainty that 15% is the line, and if you go by that, if you go past that, you've got problems in the lake. In fact, it's probably literally impossible to determine where that line is. So what the department has said is that we know aquatic plants have value. We know they're important for water quality. We know they're important for fish and wildlife habitat. We also know that we can provide property owners access to open water and stay under the 15% limit most of the time. So we've justified the 15% limit by saying it's conservative, yes, but it's low enough where we're sure we're protecting aquatic plants on a lakewide basis well enough so that we're not going to end up with water quality and habitat problems, but at the same time, we can still fulfill the need to provide shoreline owners access to open water. So that is the way that has been justified in previous rulemaking processes.
So you're not suggesting there be a 15% rule for the littoral area in the rules?
Mr. Chairman, it's already in the rules, and we're not suggesting that it be changed.
Oh, I see. So with the – how are these lakes – but the lakes that are grandfathered can go above that.
Mr. Chairman, that's correct. They can go above that at the discretion of the commissioner.
Okay.
And we've essentially been allowing them to go above that for decades.
But Mr. Chairman, that will change with the rules. They're eliminating the grandfather.
Correct. So the question is, I thought you just said that you don't know if 15% is the proper threshold or not.
Mr. Chairman, we don't know that 15% is the exact line for which if you go across it, you begin to have problems. But what we do know is that it's conservative enough that we're fairly confident that if we stay under that, that we're not going to be doing damage to our lakes.
Okay. Okay, so then explain how do you know that?
Mr. Chairman, we know it's basically intuitively because it's a very low threshold, and it keeps, you know, if you keep 85% of the lake's habitat intact, then I think you can safely assume that you're not having a lake-wide impact. We don't have any quantitative scientific studies that say that, you know, that percentage is safe for sure, but it's basically a very conservative threshold. Where the issue comes in is that the lake-wide threshold sort of prevents you from going too far on a lake-wide basis, but then there's also the issue with the nearshore habitat area, and that's where it gets into the issue of how much do you allow an individual shoreline property owner to do, because you could end up with 60, 70, 80% of the nearshore area denuded of aquatic vegetation and still stay under that 15% threshold. So we think the 15% threshold is fine, but there's also the issue of making sure that you don't have too much of that nearshore habitat taken away.
All right. Okay. Questions for department? If not, do we have other people who are going to testify?
You can. One more on your agenda. There's one on the agenda, yeah.
Pardon?
Still one on the agenda, Mr. Chairman.
I think there were some people who came in and spoke to staff afterwards that there
Eric
were.
Eric Reed?
Pardon?
Eric Reed.
All three that were on the, are on the, one, two, three.
Well, that's him right there.
All four that were on the agenda The first four that are on the agenda have testified. Now, yes. Eric Reed.
Mr. Chair and members, I'm Eric Reed with the Nature Conservancy. And I should start out by saying that TNC's approach to lobbying is typically non-confrontational. We tend not to lobby against or oppose legislation. In this case, I'm able to support something, and that is the DNR rulemaking process. And Mr. Hirsch just did a good job of giving an overview of that process. And from the Nature Conservancy, or TNC's perspective, it sets reasonable limits to chemical application and aquatic plant removal. It's led by biologists for the good of ecosystems, with input from the chemical applicator industry and from homeowners and lake homeowners associations. And it's intended to provide a balance between providing shoreline that is free from vegetation and balance that with the concept of protecting critical plant biodiversity, which serves as habitat for a variety of species. The legislation that you've got before you essentially allows for removing or chemically killing significantly more plant material than the proposed rule. And there's been a fair amount of testimony about invasive species. And I would say that this rulemaking process is about protecting ecosystems. It's not specifically about invasives. Invasives come into the equation, but it's only a small part of the equation. Weed rollers and other mechanical means of removing plants and chemicals, they kill both invasives and native plants. And so having a limit, whether that's 15% or whatever that conservative percentage is, we've got to realize that native plants are being killed as well. And I think it's important to note that chemical application in water is a lot different than chemical application on the land. I mean, if you think of the nature of water, you put a drop of red dye in a glass of water, you see that spread out throughout the water. On terrestrial invasive chemical application, you can really spot treat what plants specifically you want to hit. And you can really see if it's an invasive or a native, and you can really go around and spot treat. But you can't do that with aquatics with the same amount of precision. The issue of invasives along private shoreline is there's a big difference between that and invasives at public access points. And DNR Eco Services has a program where they police through, it's not really policing, but it's a group of about 50 people who go out to a number of different landings throughout the state, and they educate boaters and take a look to make sure that invasives are coming off of boats. And that's really the critical point. When boats are entering and leaving lakes, that's the critical point of transfer and spread for invasives. It's not whether it's in front of a lake homeowner's property or not. So I would support Mr. Hirsch's testimony on that point. Another thing that the Nature Conservancy is concerned about here is that killing too much plant life in a lake can cause the unintended consequence of algae blooms, and especially in shallow lakes. And when you've got runoff from either agriculture or lawns that have pesticides or herbicides or highways or other hard surfaces, impervious surfaces that are draining into lakes without appropriate buffer zones on them, that combined with plant material that's been removed creates an open niche for algae blooms. And once an algae bloom takes place, we know that it's extremely difficult to restore a lake to its native habitat, much more difficult than it is to restore a terrestrial ecosystem. And so we're concerned that by some language in this bill taking away the state's ability to manage shorelines and lakes by not having the DNR be able to amend their rules. That's a concern for us, because that's something that, as the science evolves on this, the DNR through rulemaking is going to be able to evolve with their rules along with it. And we do know that there's some of the lakes have lost a number of fish species. That's the canary in the coal mine that Mr. Hirsch was talking about. That's something to be concerned about. And a lot of times in natural systems, there's a long-term process of decline. And it's not easy to act as Mother Nature as the department or as the legislature or as the Nature Conservancy to just go in and fix it. There are long-term processes to restore as well. So I think taking a conservative approach to the amount of chemical application, the amount of mechanical plant removal is a good approach. Having that approach led by biologists who are trained in this field is a good approach as well. And so with that, I would stand for questions.
Okay. Now, Mr. Reed, on the has the Nature Conservancy looked at this 15% rule? Does it have any idea on what is appropriate?
Mr. Chair,
or does
and
it
members,
agree that this is just kind of a clearly safe number?
Mr. Chair and members, I would agree with Mr. Hirsch. There's no silver bullet. There's no magic number. 15% is from the DNR's experience with other lakes that have had and been living within that 15%. We haven't seen the decline in those lakes, and so that's I think it's a gut level. It's a little bit conservative, and I think that's a good approach, especially when you look at the uproar in Southeast Metro. Chemicals in water is of big concern for a lot of folks in the Southeast Metro. They've got chemicals in their drinking water, and it came through the groundwater system. That seeped in through the land and got into the drinking water system. Here, we're actually putting it directly in the water. We're putting chemicals right in the water. And so I don't think there's a magic number there. We're not taking a position on the grandfathered lakes. But we are supporting the DNR in their rulemaking process.
Mr. Reed, they're putting chemicals in the water that are designed to go in the water for that purpose. I don't want you to scare people here. I just want to be clear. These chemicals have a purpose, and they're being used appropriately. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair and Senator Scogin, you are correct that these chemicals are intended for treatment within lake systems.
Are you of the opinion that private citizens can't help?
Mr. Chair and Senator Scogin, no, I think the private citizens provided an incredible resource. Most of the people that live on lakes are there for a reason. They're there because they love the lake and they want to protect the lake. It's just the same as someone who lives in the woods somewhere. They love the natural resource. They want to protect it. I'm the former executive director of the Minnesota Conservation Corps, and we did a lot of work with terrestrial invasive species, and we also got a lot of help from individual volunteers, homeowners, working in their backyard, neighborhood groups, etc. And so the same thing holds true with lake homeowners. They want to help. And there's a level of training and a level of identification of what's an invasive, what's not an invasive, what's a native plant that, homeowners and chemical applicators that are in the business for helping homeowners treat their lakes, but it's not necessarily someone who is trained to be a biologist who's really out there to take care of the ecosystem. So there's a level of training. I'm saying that they're helpful, yes, but there's a level of training that's needed there as well.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Reed. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Senator Wilson. Let me ask if there's anyone else who wanted to testify, then we'll get to anything you wanted to rebut. Mr. Botzik?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Gary Botzik for Minnesota Conservation Federation. Senator Olson is one of my favorite senators. In fact, my very favorite tonight. I have to disagree with a lot of her bill. And let me say I respect her a great deal and all the work she's done for Lake Minnetonka and other lakes. There's no stronger advocate for clean, usable, swimmable, fishable lakes than Senator Olson. But let me also say, from a Minnesota Conservation Federation perspective, we have to be concerned about the habitat for our fisheries as well as lakeshore owners, and we are looking for that balance. And that's where DNR, that's their job, to find that balance. And one person's weeds is another person's habitat. And this problem has been around and will continue to be around. We confused, I think it was Mr. Reed that just talked about aquatic non-native invasive species. We get those two, we get that confused with aquatic plant management many times. And they're interrelated because so many of our lakes are overrun with Eurasian milfoil and curly-leaf pondweed. I have also a lot of respect for Mr. Williams. I was on the Ramsey County Parks and Rec Commission when Lake Johanna and Lake Johanna State County Park was suggested and nominated for a regional park. I serve on the Metro Parks and Open Space Commission now. When we appointed it and made it a regional park, and it's a very beautiful facility. It also has a large swimming beach associated with it, so that sometimes becomes a consideration in aquatic plant management as well. The need or the desire to have a nice swimming beach. So there you want little or no vegetation. You want sand and you want plants to be harvested, if you will, to provide that nice swimming beach, which means sand and not weeds, not plants. And that can become a problem on personal property as well, where we all want a beach area for our kids and our grandkids. And that sometimes can move into the whole habitat issue when you start destroying, or I shouldn't say destroying, but removing plants from a number of square feet or square yards, it does have an accumulative impact. Thus the 15%. Yes, it's probably conservative, but it's conservative for a reason. And we would continue to support the DNR rulemaking process. Are we here to support DNR's DNR rulemaking? It's probably the most slowest, cumbersome, burdensome process. We all know how rulemaking promulgation in this state works, and it's not fast, it's not efficient, but it's still the best way to proceed. I think it was Mr. Hirsch mentioned that this rule really reached the beginning of this marathon on December of 2005, so we're not that far out. We're only in early 2007, so we're not that far out on the rule. I think it needs time to work, needs time to play out. Appreciate Senator Olson that you removed the reference to, I think, wetlands law, as you mentioned in your amendment, also allowing the rule back in and the permit standards. I think there's a rule, prohibition of rulemaking in Section 7 that might be, maybe council can help you on that, whether this bill proceeds that in effect. It says that the rulemaking by DNR cannot proceed except for conformity with this act. So I'm not sure if that's consistent with the change in the rule, allowing the rules back in Section 1.
Well, Mr. Chairman and Mr. Botzik, that's part of the reason that we needed to take this out, because the other was actually in conflict with it. So we're not prohibiting rules, but the provisions within it need to be a part of it, is what that last statement now means.
All right. Thank you, Senator. I appreciate that. Many of us here have worked long and hard on clean water and then clean water legacy, and are looking for additional funding for that, and that relates to cleaning up impaired waters. Many of our waters, lakes and rivers, streams are impaired because of runoff, nutrients from runoff, particularly phosphorus, and a lot of us have worked on getting, and Senator Olson, big supporter of getting phosphorus out of lawn fertilizer. I know you've got a fertilizer bill up tonight, hopefully, but we worked hard to get that phosphorus out of...
A phosphorus bill, you mean?
What's that?
It's not fertilizer.
It's
phosphorus.
Phosphorus ingredient in, excuse me, Mr. Chairman, in fertilizers, lawn fertilizers. If you look on your fertilizer bags now, that middle number should be zero in the metro area, unless you're talking about new growth. We did that metro-wide. Senator Higgins carried that bill, and we went statewide a few years ago. Senator Sparks, who was here earlier, carried that bill to go statewide with the prohibition of phosphorus. We don't need phosphorus. Senator Dill's an expert on phosphorus. He could tell you stories about phosphorus readings on his farm. We don't need phosphorus in much of our lawns and even most ag land in Minnesota. So that we need to protect some of the runoff that's occurring into our waters. That's what Clean Water Legacy is all about. We're going to spend millions of dollars to get back into compliance on some of those impaired waters. And we appreciate the support that the Senate and the House both are giving in that area this year. But we need to get what do you suppose makes algae grow or what makes these plants grow is too much phosphorus. So we're doing some of the non-point remedies. We've got some of those in place. The legislature, through its lawmaking and policy and rulemaking, promulgation, is moving in the right direction. So we just encourage you, Mr. Chairman and members, to realize this is difficult. It's slow, but it's logical and needs to continue. So we support the DNR rulemaking promulgation procedure. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Mr. Chairman?
Senator Ellis.
It's been interesting to listen to this, and I've been trying to boil it down in my mind as to what the issue really is. We're not trying to take away rulemaking procedure. I think I took care of that in my author's amendment. Our license plates say we have 10,000 lakes. Some say we have closer to 14,000 lakes. We have 9 grandfathered lakes. Is that critical to the future of our fishing habitat, that 9 grandfathered lakes who have been doing a good job of managing it somehow are an obstacle to our going forward and protecting a critical habitat? I would say not. In fact, I would think that they ought to be used as an opportunity, as a laboratory, a basis for comparative research in terms of what is happening in these various circumstances as over against in other areas. I mean, these are lakes that are in developed areas that we're not having to worry about what's going to come in the future. What's there is pretty much there. The littoral area is not being proposed to be changed in either the DNR's rule or in the proposal that's before you. Nobody's talking about changing that, with the exception of preserving those 9 grandfathered lakes. Nothing has changed in terms of the permitting process and what approach can be used to managing that vegetation in that lake, be it mechanical or be it using a chemical. That can only be those that are approved within the current rule and law. So what is it, looking at this bill, what is it that's is the big hang-up? I suspect it's the opening of the door to more rigorous attack on invasives. And this may not be the precise way in which we should do it, but I think that's about the only thing left. It's the 9 lakes, is that's a really a big handicapping condition here, or is it the invasive species? The approach to dealing with invasives that's been described, I think, does not take account human behavior. If we think we can spot inspectors, college interns, out in a sampling of lakes and a sampling of public accesses at these different lakes and have them educate that, no, you shouldn't travel. You know, there's a law out here that says you can't transport vegetation on your boat on the highway. Shame. We'll kind of spank you with a wet noodle.
But now, don't do that. And that somehow, that magically is not going to happen. Now, I happen to represent a lake that has 9 major public accesses, and there are other smaller ones, and is scared to death of the zebra mussel coming. And if you want water purification, you know, you'll get it when you get the zebra mussel. It will be so pure that there will be no fish that will live in there because there won't be anything to eat. That's what the zebra mussel does to our water quality. And it usually comes on vegetation. So they're concerned. But, you know, you can have an inspector at 5 of those accesses, and at 4 open. And it only takes one boat to bring that in. And yet somehow there's a desire, even though there's a desire on the part of Lake Minnetonka to protect themselves, I don't see any proposals being aggressive on the smaller number of water bodies that now have zebra mussel of preventing. There's where the effort ought to be, preventing those from leaving with that vegetation so it gets to all of the other lakes instead of trying to protect the thousands of other lakes from getting something like this. You know, we need, and the reality, if you looked at those pictures, Minnetonka now is an exporter of milfoil. And they're willing to try to control. Should they be responsible, the homeowners around Lake Minnetonka, responsible for what leaves? It's a big order. And so you look at that mess at the Spring Park access. What should be done there? How can we control that so that we aren't having trailers with boats leaving like that and maybe pulling some off, but it only takes a little fragment that's there that gets, and it may be partially dried to get in another lake that will transmit that and really ruin a lot of lake surface area from use. And even, I know the bass fishermen love milfoil, but there's some evidence in science that when that takes over, that actually can diminish the quality of fish habitat as well. So I think we need to deal with this. And so I hope that you will allow this to be carried over for consideration. But I frankly would like to change that rulemaking part. And I would like to have a statement that if this is effected, that new rules or amendments to existing rules under the authority granted in this subdivision are not effective until they've been submitted to the legislature and approved. I think this is an important policy area, and I think that it needs to be looked at because I believe that the main issue that it is bringing in is the dealing with invasives. I think none of these people are arguing at all that we shouldn't be protecting and managing and keeping a quality fish habitat and native plant species in our water bodies. And I was also reminded, as I've been sitting here listening to all of this, Senator Saxog and I happen to represent the Senate on the Governor's Conservation Legacy Council. And that council is charged with examining all of our governance, if you will, of natural resources and conservation entities, as well as the funding levels of them, and to come back with recommendations. If you take the legislators out of the picture, there's an interesting mix of people representing a range of interest groups and a great deal of expertise. But one of the things that came through loud and clear as I've sat and listened to them is the importance of citizen involvement. And there's been an admission here that there hasn't necessarily been an effective respect for the contribution of property owners, lakeshore owners, and as well as their commitment to the environment as well. And so that there appears to be some lack of balance in the kind of citizen input that is going into this process. And that's a major issue that we're going to be looking at in terms of the whole governance and the role that citizens can have in protecting something that's extremely important to them. And so I think whatever comes of that at this point is beside the point. But I bring it up because I believe these citizens are and their perspectives, the experiences they've had, are worthy of respect. And I believe that we ought to give them due consideration, and I would appreciate, and I know you represent many of the same kind of people that are very knowledgeable, very committed, very passionate. And I would hope that you would support this. If we could make an amendment to that rule part.
Hey, Mr. Knopf, where would that be inserted?
Well, Mr. Chairman, Senator Olson, if you're going to have a broad statement like that, I think it should be part of the statutory language and not in a separate. What you have here is an uncodified section. And I think it'd be better to add that in section one of your bill to make a new paragraph D.
Yes.
Because that's where the authority is granted, and it, as I understand it, you're talking about that would be kind of a permanent part of this. Is that they couldn't promulgate or adopt rules until it's gone through the legislature.
And we may have this. Do you have a copy of this amendment?
Well. Mr. Chairman, Senator Olson, yeah, I
the A1. It's written but, as a delete all, but I think that for our consideration, if you would consider laying it over for consideration in the bill, I would like to leave the major text as amended there, but add this provision.
Okay, so this is the A1.
Yeah. And Mr. Chairman, Senator Olson, I think what you would do is you would add it after line 1.22, you would add the new language from the amendment.
Thank you.
Okay, so this be a paragraph this D. Would not be a delete everything.
No, that's correct.
So we would strike the line on line 2 of the amendment, and you would insert what?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I think what you'd here's how the best way to modify the amendment would be to delete everything on lines 1.2 to 1.8 from the amendment, and insert. Insert page 1 after line 22, insert. And then you would, on one line 1.9, instead of B, that would be a D. And then delete line 1.2 and delete the title amendments, too, because that. So basically, you would delete 1.12 to 1.17 from the amendment also. So all you're left with basically is page 1 after line 2, and what was on the amendment as paragraph B would be now paragraph D, and that would be the entirety of the amendment.
I would move that amendment.
Okay. Any discussion? This basically says that on this issue, legislature has to approve any rules, or is it in general? Or does it just apply to this rule?
Mr. Chairman, it just applies to this particular, the aquatic species portion. It's not covering all rulemaking.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, it says on 1.10, under the authority granted in this subdivision. So.
Okay. Mm-hmm. All right. Everyone understand the amendment? Okay. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails, amendments adopted.
And Mr. Chairman, I think to be consistent, I should have added this before, you'd want to delete Section 7 from your bill, as I understand it?
I would so move.
Okay. On that motion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails, amendments adopted. As we consider this, Senator Olson, I guess I'm also interested in the answer to a few questions. We don't have to talk about it now. We've got some time before we do the omnibus bill. I guess I'd like the answer to the question of why these 7 lakes and 2 bays should be treated differently than the other 14,000 lakes in Minnesota. And the other question I have is why herbicidal treatment is the central issue in lake quality and not all the other issues of shoreline management and other things that we do to contribute to healthy lakes. Because it seems to me that it should be taken as a whole, and we're only looking at one piece. We're raising the issue of aquatics under your bill, in aquatic invasives, but it's only applying to 7 lakes. and in only one fashion, and that's, you know, chemical treatment. So I guess I think I need those questions answered for my purposes as well. I'm a little concerned by statements about property values. I spent a year looking for lakeshore property, and from everything I researched, my fishing was going to be way better if there was more weeds in front of my in front of the property. So I guess I'd like to hear a little bit about that. And then the statement about Mr. Idy's testimony about significant runoff from freeways and adjacent land. There's the discussion from Mr. Reed about, I think it was, no, it was Mr. Botzik, that about the algae coming from phosphorus, and that comes from runoff, and shoreline management is a huge part of preventing that. And we might not even have to do a lot of treatment if there was better shoreline management on these seven lakes.
Mr. Chairman, I think that we've been dealing with that issue. The shoreland is probably more critical. The notion that somehow that the aquatic vegetation is going to handle all of the phosphorus loading that's coming with runoff is, I think, unrealistic. So we clearly have more issues than what this bill or the issues that have been raised tonight certainly address. But that's if we wouldn't have any reason to meet if we didn't have all of these complicated issues to try to cope with.
Okay.
So, all right. But I appreciate the respect and the good questions, and I would move if you're willing to lay this over for possible consideration in the omnibus.
Okay. I can just lay it over, but if you'd like to move that, we can do that as well. On Senator Olson's motion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed?
No.
No.
Motion prevails. Why don't we...
thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I don't think Senator Saxhaug's bill is going to take very long. Let's go ahead and get it done. We have very little time, which means the testimony will be very brief, too.
Chairman, many of us remember the testimony on a similar bill from about 3-4 years ago.
Yes, yes. Do we have opponents on this bill?
4 years ago we did.
Yeah. This was on that was on the phosphorus ban. I think the industry favors this bill now.
Right.
Same. Yeah.
Same. Some of the opponents are now proponents.
Oh yeah. Okay. Okay. Senate File 1109.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. Today I'm presenting, as you said, Senate File 1109. This bill will ban retail sales of dishwasher detergent with more than 0.5% phosphorus by weight. With me today is Jan Wingler from her organization makes Electrosol, and she's going to give some testimony and answer any questions.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, Senators, I will keep it brief. I know I see that it is late in the evening. I am Jan Wingler. I'm the Director of Government Affairs for a company called Reckitt Benckiser. You won't recognize the name of the company, but we do make Electrosol. And we are the number two selling brand in the U.S. and in Canada. Worldwide, we are number one. We're right behind Procter & Gamble and the rest of the world. And I am here to ask for your support of the household ban starting July 2010, lowering it to 0.5% phosphorus. We still agree with the study done in Minnesota in 2004, which found that the phosphorus in automatic dishwashing detergent is a very, very small contributor to the concentrations that you see in the wastewater treatment facilities. Nevertheless, industry has decided to go towards a nationwide reduction with the date of July 2010, bringing the phosphorus in the household product down to 0.5%. We need this amount of time because we've got to do the research and development to come up with a very efficacious product Then we're going to have to work with our suppliers to build our raw material supplies, possibly doing any remodeling or building of new plants, building the product up in the supply chain, and then giving the retailers and wholesalers the opportunity to go ahead and clear their inventory of the phosphate-containing product. We hope to have an orderly transition in the market from the phosphate-containing product to the phosphate-free product by the July 2010 date, and we're pursuing this in a number of states, and we're here to ask your help with that by supporting the July 2010 date that's in this legislation.
Senator Dill.
Well, Mr. Chairman, members, I was involved in this several years ago when my constituent south of Dassel, who lives in Lake Jenny, came to the legislature and he said, you know, you're overlooking something here. There's a fair amount of phosphorus that's getting into our surface waters through the use of dishwashing machine soap. And nobody seemed to really pick up on that. I thought, that kind of seems a little hard to believe. And so, but a bill was introduced to ban phosphorus from dishwashing machine soap at that time. And it got partway through the system, and as kind of the booby prize or the compromise at the end of the day, we decided to do a study to find out where the phosphorus is really coming from that's entering the surface waters of the state. And what I passed out today doesn't have my name on it, but it comes out of this livestock book that we went over part of that the other day when we had my urban sprawl bill up. And if you look at the chart that I've got here, this is a result of this bar engineering study and where all the phosphorus is coming from, and you'll see automatic dishwasher detergent soap. Detergent is in 10th place, contributing 2.8% of the phosphorus from all, this chart is a combination of both non-point and point sources of phosphorus, and by blending those two together, automatic dishwasher detergent soap is in 10th place at contributing 2.8% of all the phosphorus entering the surface waters of the state of Minnesota. And, of course, this book is, that I took it out of is focusing on feedlots, which is in 13th place, only 1%. So, anyway, the man's name was Doug Hedin, who came up with this idea, and he still lives south of Dassel. And now, after all these years that have gone by, I'm going to send him a copy of Senator Saxhog's bill so he can see that his efforts so many years ago has finally paid off.
Mr. Chair, Senator Dill, thanks for bringing us up to date on that history.
Senator Fredrickson.
Mr. Chairman, Ms. Wengler is...
Wengler.
Ms. Wengler. There are dishwasher products on the market now that are zero phosphorus. Since the last time we debated this bill, that's about all we've used in our household are those that have no phosphorus. I don't know how long it'll take you to convert or develop a new formula for your dishwashing detergents.
Well, Mr. Chair and Senator, you're right. There are products on the market right now that are phosphate-free. And, you know, we've never said that phosphorus-free products did not work. Our issue is the efficacy of the product for our customers. We tried in Europe to switch to a phosphate-free product in the 90s, and it failed miserably to the point where the governments gave us permission to put phosphate back into the product. And the other company, Procter & Gamble, fortunately it wasn't my company, they did an experiment in Arizona bringing a phosphate-free product out that they felt would really gain wonderful acceptance. And it was a test market there, and it also failed miserably. So we're very, very aware that as everybody has different types of patterns in their dishwashing and different soils and very different water hardnesses, that some people can use the phosphate-free products, and it works quite well. But then others, they just don't work. So our drive is to develop a product that makes the normal Electrosol purchaser happy with their product. So that's why it will take us till the July 2010, we feel, to come up with a good product there for them.
What's wrong with doing the same for commercial detergents?
We don't make the commercials, and I believe Jeff Peterson will be here, and he'll address that. Jeff?
Welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chairman, members, my name is Jeff Peterson. I'm Director of Government Relations for a company called Ecolab based here in St. Paul, and we are manufacturers and distributors of cleaning and sanitizing products for practically everything outside the household, which includes the industrial and institutional markets. And we do manufacture a large number or a large quantity of automatic dishwashing products used in the commercial sector. And to respond to the question, there are not alternatives available now in the commercial market. Dishwashing in a commercial setting is different, considerably different than those in the household. And if you just think about the volume of dishes that have to be washed for the number of different people that are using them with the number of different food soils, and even the systems that are being used, the water is much hotter, larger volumes of water. The cycle runs about a minute, whereas a household cycle will run something like 20 minutes. And we've looked at the issue. I mean, we've been aware of the interest in having less phosphorus, and we use less phosphorus than we used to. But with all the substitutes and alternatives that we've looked at, we've not been able to come up with something that meets the standards, the public health standards, the standards of cleanliness and sanitization that's required by automatic dishwashing in public sector that has to meet public health standards.
Well, Electrosol doesn't have a good substitute either. Isn't that what you said, Ms. Winkler?
That's true. We're working, Mr. Chairman, yes, that's true. We're working towards it. But our type of cleaning systems are very, very different than the industrial cleaning systems. And the concern for public health within a household, we found, it's a little different than in a hospital or in a restaurant or in a school.
Well, according to Senator Dill, it is very different. Automatic dishwasher deterrent is 2.8% of phosphorus contributors, but commercial industrial is 12%, so four times the difference.
But that's not
phosphorus contributions.
Mr. Chairman, I the industrial that you're referring to, I don't believe is the automatic dishwashing. If I remember the numbers correctly from the study, 2.9 is combined household and institutional, and of that, 0.9% is the institutional number, and 1.9 is the household automatic dishwashing.
Senator Dill.
Mr. Chairman, in the report, the way they put this together, they have one chart for non-point and one chart for point source of phosphorus, and I put the two charts together to create the chart you see here. And the commercial industrial water use, I don't know that references any kind of detergent, the third one down. I would think the number 10 is a blend of automatic dishwashing detergent for both commercial and household use, I would think.
Well, you'd have till 2010 to figure something out, just like Electrosol. Isn't that enough time?
Well, Mr. Chairman, it's a good question. As I said, it's an issue that we've looked at for a long period of time, and if we were forced to, we would have to have something for our customers and restaurants and hospitals. We're not confident that we can get something that works as well. We'd feel very uncomfortable providing an inferior product in that type of setting, and we're also quite confident that it would be substantially more expensive, and that's not a good combination.
Mr. Chair, with all due respect, that my bill involves residential dishwasher detergent, so I just soon deal with that.
But it specifically exempts commercial and institutional. That's what I was asking. What if we had something that's sunsetted in 3 years, a requirement that's sunsetted in 3 years for commercial and institutionals? If you didn't have just couldn't get something together by then, you could remove the sunset.
Well, Mr. Chairman, if we had to, we would get something together. We'd be very concerned about our ability to provide something at the level would be public health and safety standards that we have to meet. The type of dishes and ware washing that's done is subject to inspection by health departments. It's a pretty high standard that we have to meet, and you know, as I said, we've looked at a number of alternatives. The principal alternative that's available in Europe, and by the way, most European countries also have phosphorus in their automatic dishwashing, but it's a substance called NTA. And the few countries that don't use phosphorus have NTA. And NTA is a suspected carcinogen. It's something that we wouldn't use in the United States. And so short of that, all the other alternatives that we've looked at have not provided satisfactory results in the type of systems that we have to use. We have some limitations. As an example, in the household sector, they use enzymes, which are fairly common, which are, I guess, fairly satisfactory at temperatures of 120 degrees, which they have in households. Our temperatures are about 180 degrees, and enzymes are destroyed. So that's not an alternative that we have available.
Senator Fredrickson.
Mr. Chairman, I was just going to suggest that all of us around this table in the Senate will be here 4 years from now, and this is for 3 years. Maybe we can revisit this in 2 or 3 years and see how the residential industry is doing and talk to Mr. Peterson again and see if there's something developing or spinning off of the residential side, and we could revisit this issue again for the commercial side.
Mr. Chair, we have one more brief statement of testimony. Mr. Johnson.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Craig Johnson, representing the League of Minnesota Cities. We're very appreciative of Senator Saxhog and of the industry in coming forward with this legislative proposal. As I think all of you are aware, our municipal wastewater treatment plants are facing increasing regulation of phosphorus discharges and of bearing the costs of adding that treatment, both the infrastructure and the ongoing operation and maintenance. While this seems like a small step in that it addresses a small percentage of the water going or the phosphorus load going into a system and overall in the state, in some of our systems, it's much higher than in others. It depends greatly on how many dishwashers you've got in the area, how many resorts, how many other things like that you have, how many restaurants, and phosphorus load can add up. And anything that contributes to the load of phosphorus is a cost for that wastewater treatment plant to remove that phosphorus later. So, as I think we've all learned over and over, it is much cheaper to have it removed in the first place than to try and do treatment later to remove it after the fact, and we very much appreciate this effort to help limit municipal costs on treating phosphorus.
I wish the folks from the previous bill were here to hear all this. Okay.
Mr. Chairman, I think it's commendable that the industry coalesced around this bill.
Yes, it's a good thing. It's a very good thing. Anyone else need to testify against the bill?
Thanks, Craig.
Okay, Senator Saxhog, anything else?
No. No, I just moved that Senate File 1109, either be sent to the floor or sent to your table, whichever works.
If there's no further Senator.
Mr. Chairman, I understand. I'm pretty sure that the House already sent this to the floor, so I think it would be commendable if we could do the same.
Yeah,
and dispose of at least something on the floor in the next few days.
The policy bills that have not been going to other committees or don't have money in them, I've been laying over for inclusion in our omnibus bill, and that's what I intend to do with this. So if there's no further discussions,
Mr. Chairman, I would move to amend Senator Saxhog's motion, if he doesn't dispute it, that we send this to the floor. Pass it and send it to the floor.
You're free to make that motion. Senator Saxhog is aware of what the process was going to be with this bill. And
Mr. Chairman, I don't know if you're going to have room for everything in the omnibus bill. Then how will you marry it up to the House bill? Which has already gone to the floor there.
Well, the same way we'll be marrying up all the provisions in the omnibus bill in one omnibus bill.
Mr. Chairman, I just don't think
House.
We have time for that this year. Even if we stay here for the whole year, taking out one piece at a time out of an omnibus just to marry it to something that came out clean in the House.
Yeah. It's actually faster with the omnibus bill because then we don't have to take all the Senate files on the floor on general orders. So, Senator Parisel, you have moved to amend Senator Saxhog's motion? Is that where we're at, or you still want to do that?
I would like to do that, but Senator Saxhog's intent, so.
Senator Saxhog?
Mr. Chair, I'm not about to challenge the chair. Whatever you think is the way you want it is fine with me.
All right. Well, I mean, if we're not going to follow the, you know, the process that's been established for this committee, I've been completely fair and balanced about how I've been approaching all of these bills. If there's going to be dispute about that, we just won't hear bills.
So on the Parasol motion, further discussion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
Aye.
Motion does not prevail. Senate file 1109 will be laid over for consideration in the omnibus policy bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
Meeting's adjourned.